But don't play with me, 'cause you're playing with fire. But don't play with me, 'cause you're playing with fire.
Morning, welcome to Playing with Fire, Long Island's only food, wine, and lifestyle show. I'm your host, Tom Shardell. And I'm here, as usual, with co-host and producer Stu Schrager. Good morning, Stu.
Good morning, Tom. And how are you?
I'm good. I got a, you know, a couple things going here. I bought a new car. Did I tell you this?
No. We heard about the almost purchase of a Porsche, a Maserati or something a couple of months ago.
I can't afford a Maserati. I was thinking about, you know, every 5 years I get this wiggy to get a sports car. And it goes away. It's like the motorcycle thing. Every 5 years I get like, should I buy a motorcycle? Should I get another, you know, bike? And then I sit in front of a fan that blows wind in my face, and the feeling goes away. But the sports car thing is funny because, you know, I've had some sports cars over the years. I had a 560 SL Mercedes, a little two-seater. And I had a couple of Porsches, you know. I had a Boxster, I had a Targa, and I had a Carrera. And I'm getting to the point where I can't get in and out of them anymore. They're too low, you know. So anyway, I get the wiggy right. I go down. I was looking at the Porsches, and you know, my business partner Eddie has a couple of Panameras, I think they call them, the four seater. I'm like, well, that's cool, you know, because I was over his house doing a party. He's got like three of them, you know. So I went over there. I'm like, yeah, this is a kind, you know, four seat. Okay, I can do that. It's a bigger car, this, that, and the other thing. And then I went to price them out. They're like $180,000. I'm saying, I'm out. You know, there's no way I would do that. And I can't anyway. So, you know, it's just a moot point, right? So I got wind of the Genesis. And I didn't realize Genesis is the high-end Hyundais. You know, it's like... Lexus is the high-end Honda or whatever.
It's the car of choice for Tiger Woods.
Oh, is it really?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I hope he drives it better than he drove the last one. Anyway, so I go down to Genesis deal, and I get this little GL70 or whatever it's called. And it's a cool little car, you know. It's like a little sports car. So I said, all right, let me take this for a test drive. So, you know, I get in it, you know, I drive around. It's got some pep to it. I'm like, yeah, this is kind of cool. Then I can't get out. You know, it's like, I'm like, I got my hand out for the guy to pull me out of the car. I'm like, this is ridiculous. So I'm looking at their SUVs. I figured maybe I'll just act my age. I'll get an SUV, you know, like I've always had. And I have to have two cars, you know, because I put so much mileage on them. Anyway, so look at the SUVs, and they're like, you know, 65,000 to 85,000, depending on what you got on it. And I'm thinking, yeah, really? You know, it's a lot of money, right? So I happen to go next door. And I see this Hyundai Tucson. Now, I have a Hyundai Santa Cruz. I used to have, I don't even know why I'm telling you this, but I used to have this full-size Ram pickup, you know. But it was like trying to dock the Queen Mary every time you have to, you know, park the thing. It's like the Titanic. You know, you got to make a 17-point turn to turn the thing around. It's 150 feet long, you know. But they had this Santa Cruz, which is kind of cool for me because it's like a, like almost like a sports truck. With a little bed in the back, you know, and I don't do big parties.
That's
anymore.
The white truck you
yeah,
had.
Yeah.
That's
one
a cool
has
truck.
The flat, yeah. One had the flat. So anyway, you know, Hyundai. What occurred to me was that they have a 10-year powertrain warranty on it, and I'm thinking, at my age, this could be the last car I buy, right? So I'd like it to last. And usually I lease, you know, but I want to buy this thing. So I got this souped up. Tucson, you know, thing with floorboards and running things and roof racks in case I decide to take up skiing in my 80s, whatever. And it's kind of cool. Runs real well, you know. It's tight, you know. Kind of a cool.
Wait, little. So this is the one you had the flat on, or you replaced?
No. So I still have the one that I have the flat on, but now I have another one. I have a Tucson, Hyundai Tucson.
Okay.
So now I'm a Hyundai guy. I'm, you know,
wow.
So
my car story is interesting. We work with Rally Motors. Rally Motor Company has four brands that they have.
Yeah.
They have Mercedes-Benz, BMW, Acura, and Lexus. And they're celebrating their 65th anniversary. Their showrooms are in Roslyn, Glen Cove, and Westbury. And so being their 65th anniversary, they wanted to do some special events throughout the year, both for their staff, which mm-hmm. is pretty cool, and then for the community. Mrs. Terrian, who is the matriarch of the company, actually donated $1 million to Morgan Park in Glen Cove, which is an incredible giving of of money.
I'm in the wrong business, apparently.
But what's really cool is, again, in today's world of philanthropy, the donation she gave will never be used, in a sense, because it's put in a trust with, and it's interest-bearing, and the principal will never be used. The I guess the interest on the
money
will fund the park, both with musical entertainment and maintenance forever, which is amazing to think about.
I'm always skeptical when politicians have a piece of money somewhere. They always seem to get their hands on it somehow.
Right, right. Well, that's similar. That's like with these co-ops and stuff. You know, you sign a contract, you pay whatever your monthly thing is, and then the board decides, oh, we need to do this project.
Roof,
all of a sudden, there's a, you know, you're paying $700 each month, and then they need to do something. There's a contingency fund, and then again, and, you know, and actually that's a problem in today's world, because a lot of people in fixed incomes have this situation where they can pay whatever they've been paying, and then when all these different, in today's world with storms and all sorts of craziness, it just goes out of control. But getting back to my story, so what they also did was they took, there's a big initiative in today's world for electric cars. So they had a BMW iX, which is a pretty high-end car. It's like over $100,000, and it's fully electric. It's not hybrid. It's fully electric. So they had it wrapped with all this artwork and just exploiting the fact that it's the 65th anniversary. And my role in this is I get to drive it around.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm supposed to take it to high-profile events and just
make sure it's charged.
Well, that's where we're going, Tom. So the fact that it's not really mine, so I don't have the high voltage charging station at my house.
Yeah, why would you?
I don't really take the car home. It stays here at the station and during the day, and if we're going to events, I take it out. So lo and behold, the first time around, all of a sudden, I realize I'm at 6%, and I got a little nervous. Because I don't know about you, you know, these dashboards today, you know, they tell you got this many miles on a gas-powered car. I wasn't sure how accurate it was. So I started panicking. But they gave me an electric cord to plug in if it needs to be charged on traditional voltage. Because I guess it's 110 will work, but
takes forever.
Yeah. And I'll tell you about that. And then 220 is what normal people use if they have a home charging station. But there's also different levels of that. So at any rate, I get to my house and I'm panicking because 6%, what's going to go on? And I see the cord. I said, okay, I'm going to plug it in. Well, I put it on my driveway, probably about 4 feet short of the outlet.
Of course.
I'm not exaggerating. I literally had to put the car on my front lawn.
Really?
And plug it in. And I was real proud of myself at that point.
How'd the neighbors feel?
Well,
Stu's drinking again.
What's really funny is I have a pretty big audience because I live across the street from an apartment complex. So they must have thought I was off the deep end.
Yeah.
So I plug it in and I check to see if it's charging. And for argument's sake, if it was the 20th of the month, it said at 10 a.m. on the 29th, it would be fully charged. I can't make this up, Tom.
No, this whole electric car thing.
So, again, I get home at like 9 o'clock. I leave to work the next morning at like 7 o'clock. It charged 5%.
Yeah.
So that was, you know, I went from 6 to 11.
Yeah, this is where we're going. He's going to, you know, the president's going to have this all figured out by 2026.
Right. So that weekend, the radio station has its big event. We have something called Pumpkin Park over at Adventureland.
Uh-huh.
And again, nice place to have the car on display.
Sure.
And I said to myself, wow, the car's going to be sitting here for a couple of days. Why don't I Plug it in. And even if it takes a long time, it doesn't matter. So we're at the amusement park. The amusement park, I guess, is all electric. So first they had it somewhere. I said, well, again, I had the idea about plugging it in. Could I get near an outlet? No problem. They give me a place. I plug it in. I only stayed at the event for like half the day. I thought I was in good shape. I come back the next day. It's unplugged. Nothing had happened.
You're not using my electricity.
So I plug it in. And then all of a sudden, I start getting all these faults and everything. And I'm going, oh, my God. I'm going to bring down the adventure park.
I can see it now. Some 3-year-old stuck in a Ferris wheel.
Yeah. So I said, forget about it. I just rolled up the cord, put it back in. And that night, Sunday night, it's over the event. It was a two-day event. They actually have charging stations at Adventureland.
Oh, yeah.
But you pay for it.
Yeah, yeah.
So, again, the world is crazy. So I go out there. And I go to, you know, I figure it's like a parking meter.
Right.
No, you got to have an app.
Oh, really?
So I fill out the app, and then it starts telling me about how my card is in the mail. And I go, but I want to do this now. I don't want to wait for.
Yeah.
But I read more into it, and until your card came, you can still do something. So I put $50 on my fantasy card.
Yeah, yeah.
Put it in, and come back the next day, fully charged.
Really?
And it tells me my card, I owe them $152. So to charge the car, this is ridiculous. To charge the car from almost nothing to fully charged was $202. So
they got it all figured out, Stu.
Oh, yeah. Well, it gets a little more easy. So then, I'm 100% and I'm doing my thing. And then somebody says something about Stop and Shop has free charging stations.
I've seen those, yeah.
And it's not at every Stop and Shop. But I, after having the example of where I had to use a credit card to do it, I was skeptical. Mm. So I go over there. Lo and behold, you plug it in. And the enticement is you're supposed to go and shop.
Yeah,
so I do, but yeah. I forget to take the car home so it can charge. So it turns out that it's like 7% every hour that the car charges. So apparently it might be the 220 charging station, but it's a low power one.
Right, right, right.
You know, not high performance or whatever. Yeah, but yeah. It gets it done. But it's just, again, when you start thinking about it, a lot of people want to experience an electric car, a Tesla, whatever. So they go on vacation, and there's an option, you know, do you want an electric car or not? So some people are doing a Tesla as a rental car.
Yeah.
But that's, again, real easy if, number one, your hotel has a charging station. If it doesn't, what do you spend the vacation trying to find the charging station?
I know. The whole thing is so idiotic. I mean, you know, Ford is losing its shirt trying to build these electric cars. Nobody wants them. I mean, you could get one tomorrow if you wanted to.
Tom, and now you just hit a sore point. This is salt in the wound. You said Ford.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I read that they're going to start taking AM radio out of the cars, and it turns out BMW too.
Really?
I can't listen to our show on Sunday mornings on the AM signal.
No, we have to get the FM signal.
That's right. So fortunately, 104.7 WHLI FM allows me to still listen to the show. But again, it's crazy. And then there's this new thing called Turo. It's like Airbnb. Instead of for lodging, it's for cars.
Yeah.
So individuals take their car and they rent it out.
Really?
And there's a whole system with insurance and this, that,
yeah,
and the other.
Yeah, yeah.
So, again, people that want to use a Tesla, the guy goes, you know, they leave a lockbox, actually, on your car.
Uh-huh.
And then you open it up, you get the remote, and
you
go on your way.
Huh.
So normally with a rental car, like if I'm returning a car, you can pay for prepaid gas or you fill it up at the end. So 9 out of 10 times, Gary and I are traveling, we stop at the gas station on the way to return the car.
Yeah.
So that takes 2 minutes. Your Tesla's half charged, and you got to return it. What do you do?
I don't know.
So the guy goes to – my boss was going to lease a Tesla for a vacation. The guy goes, you know, just charge it and bring it back. And he goes, I can't do that.
You know, all this green energy stuff, I mean, in theory, yeah, okay, you know, nobody wants to hurt the planet, but we're not ready. You know, you can't even keep the lights on in New York City when the air conditioners are going, you know, full blast in August, right? And they're going to add, what, 6 million cars to this? It's insane. I mean, look at all this, you know, like Solyndra, you know, when Obama was trying to, you know, do the green energy thing, and they backed Solyndra. They lost millions and millions and millions of dollars. You know, nobody wants the windmills in their backyard. The whole thing is just not thought out, you know, just rushed to be.
That's another crazy thing. I'm not all that well versed on it. And look at us talking about food.
Yeah. Well, food for thought.
Thank you.
Yeah, there you go.
But with the wind power, apparently there's wind power coming offshore here on Long Island, and the unions are all very pro wind power because they feel that. It's going to provide a lot of jobs and new technology training for the future so that the community will have jobs and it will improve economy and all this. But then there's
all the while killing the whales.
Well, that's what I'm not all that up on that. But, yeah, I found out that there's a lot of people up in arms about the wind power and something about the cable that's coming from offshore to the beaches and whatever is going to happen to the ecology. So it really, really is confusing. And then even with the electric cars, there's all sorts of questions about the batteries, producing the batteries and where the supplies come from and how it's evasive
China,
to the territory, to the to terrain.
Yeah.
So... yeah, the world's in a strange spot.
We always do. You know, this country's funny. It just, you know, never gets conquered. It's just going to commit suicide. I mean, you know, we won't drill for oil here in the United States. We'd rather get it from our enemies. You know, we don't make lithium batteries here. We want to get it from our enemies. I mean, it's insane. You know, these politicians, you wonder what they're thinking. And, being the skeptic and the cynic that I am, I mean, it's always money. I mean, there's always some kind of money in it for somebody down there, you know.
But it really does get crazy because there's just so much a craziness associated with it. And bring it back to food. At one point, I think Governor Hochul put into legislation something about not having gas-fired stoves anymore or something.
It's all insane. You know, I mean, we have enough gas reserves here for the next 2 billion years, you know, and they refuse to use them. I don't understand it, you know, for the life of me. Why would you want to be dependent on, you know, countries like Saudi Arabia, you know, who, you know, have a track record of being ridiculous, you know? So, I don't know. It's you know, listen, when I look at, you know, I've done dinners in the Senate building. I've interacted with these people. I did it for 14 years. And all the people you see on TV arguing back and forth, you know, a Democrat this, a Republican that, they're all friends. You go down there, they're all slapping each other on the back, having cocktails together. It's all one big kabuki theater. And it's about money. I mean, you know, the average senator makes $175,000 a year, and somehow in 5 years they're worth tens of millions of dollars. I mean, how does this happen, you know? We know how it happens. So, anyway, enough of that. We got to talk about food, all right?
We should. And just a little interlude, hopefully not painful for you, but I'm actually going to dinner at Bijou, which is your former Jewel and Bijou.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what – at one point I heard that it was French, Asian, fusion. I don't know if that's accurate. But knowing that I was going there, I woke up this morning with the strangest thought. Like the day you turned over the keys to that building, and for our listeners that have been to Jewel while it was open, what an incredible ambiance and decor. It really was. To me, it was just it was Las Vegas here on Long Island. Do you have any insight into, first of all, what the cuisine is there at this point? And number two, did they mess with the decor?
To answer your first question, I think the cuisine is contemporary American with Asian influence. That would be, I think it started out a little stronger Asian-wise, but I think it's tempered a little bit. And Tony Scotto, I consider him a buddy, you know? I mean... I have a lot of respect for Tony and what he does. He builds good restaurants, and he's a smart guy. I think they did the place over. And I understand it. I mean, you know, look, you could have left it the way it was, but I think Tony wants to put his own mark on his own places, which is totally understandable, you know. And, you know, if you got the wherewithal to do that, by all means, go, you know. And so I think it's a completely different place. The thing I will say is that I think that, you know, at the time we sold it to Tony, it was September before the pandemic. It was September of 19, you know. And the sad part is that, you know, we used to do, you know, 200 lunches a day there. It was really busy because you had all those buildings in the area, whatever. And all the places on 110 did the same. I mean, you know, Blackstone's always very busy for lunch and, you know, his place 110 or whatever. But now the sad part is that, you know, there's a lot of people that aren't in the buildings anymore. People work from home and, you know, whatever. So I think that market is dried up.
Well, that's interesting you say that. My understanding is that I'm not sure about that, but 110, I believe, is not open for lunch
anymore. Yeah.
Which also brings me to just a quick question. Do you know what that format is? Italian. Yeah, that's what I thought.
Yeah, it's an Italian restaurant. You know, Tony's specialty is the steakhouses. You know,
right.
Mean, obviously, he does them really well. He's got, you know, Blackstone and Rare and Insignia is his too. You know, he does those really well. I think he has Volpe, if I'm not mistaken. I think he owns that hotel over there in Woodbury.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And so, you know, he's just, like I said, he's a smart guy. My only thought on that was when I asked him why he wanted to, you know, buy, you know, Jewel, because he was right in the middle. He had 110 on one side, Blackstone on the other. It seemed like he was taking money out of his left pocket and sticking it in his right, you know. But he was afraid that somebody else was going to come in there and, you know, upset the 110 lock that he sort of had on it, you know, which I guess, you know, is a good idea. I mean, you know, look, I think Bijou now is more of a nightclub.
Which is interesting, and I was just going to say to you, because I happened to be at Blackstone last night, mm-hmm. and I was talking to the man in the know, the valet guy.
Yeah, well, they know everything.
And he said that Thursday nights they had a DJ over at Bijou, and that made me think, is that like supposed to be a younger crowd? As compared to a little more aged over at Blackstone. But Blackstone was actually doing pretty well. Thursday night, there were a lot of business people there. And it can't be that they're starting to have holiday parties, really, even though I was actually there for a networking group holiday party.
Oh, yeah. That's
but
funny.
But the tables were I saw a lot of tables of young guys.
Sure.
Looked like business people. And it was, you know, pretty crowded, high-end cars out front or whatever.
Yeah, the steakhouses draw that crowd. I mean, you know, look, steakhouses to me have always been gourmet restaurants for people who don't know anything about food. And I don't mean that in a smart-assy way. I just mean it's, you know, if you're not really into, you know, a La Bernardin or a Portale or something that has interesting food, but you still want to be a big shot and spend a bunch of money, you know, steakhouses are perfect for that.
It's funny, just to give a little review of Blackstone. So we had a holiday party for a networking group, mm-hmm. and walking in there, you walk towards the side of the restaurant and you walk through the seafood area, right. And they got these beautiful lobsters on ice and oysters and clams and shrimp or whatever. Looks very appealing. And I guess if you would walk straight into the restaurant, I guess the sushi bar, I guess, is on the back wall. And on the left traditional
bar.
Alcohol and spirits bar. The weird thing of the evening, the food was all good, but they have a couple of private rooms that it would be like walking along a wall and there was three closet doors, you know, and you go, each one is like a garage or a narrow area.
Let's make it
deal. And then they open up to another room that runs across the back of it.
Right.
And when you have a lot of people, it doesn't lend itself to getting around. The waiters are trying to do the past hors d'oeuvres. They can't get by.
Yeah.
The other help that's trying to take your used napkin or, you know, empty plate, mm-hmm. they can't get around. Just really weird. If it would have been an open area, a lot more easy to mingle, because that's what it was about, networking and mingling.
Yeah, yeah.
So that actually was the only critique. And again, the individual rooms probably had 4 tables that they could handle for like maybe 6 people. So I guess each room technically, if first seated, people. Would be like 20,
yeah, yeah.
you know, 20 guests or whatever. And this probably was more like 100 people.
Mm.
But again, it just the flow of it didn't really work to me. So as nice of a night it could have been, again, the purpose was to be able to mingle and get around, and I found that hard to do.
Yeah, well, it's you know, look, everybody's trying to get as many people in as they can, you know. Restaurant business is, you know, we've been talking about this for weeks. It's in a tough period right now. You know, you can go past places and they look busy and all of that, but what most people don't realize is that when you see busy parking lots, it's usually Friday and Saturday night. You know, it's generally a 2-night-a-week business in the suburbs, you know. In the cities, it's different, but in the suburbs, you know, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, loopy. You know, Wednesday, maybe Thursday.
My mind is shot, but I know recently I've been out and about during the week, and I've been pretty impressed on a Tuesday or Wednesday that some places, and not for a function, just had a decent
amount of people.
Yeah,
no, that's good to hear.
But
I mean, I hope that's the case. You know, I'm a fan of the business, and I you know, I want everybody to do well.
And what's interesting about Long Island is the different geographies. Melville. Apparently is a somewhat affluent area.
Oh, yeah.
And
Long Island's affluent. You know, you have pockets where people, you know, are less affluent for sure. But for the most part, you know, try and buy a house here. You know, it's getting like California here. I mean, you know, start a home, $600,000.
But that 110 corridor, you know, in again, I guess that's the northern part is Melville. The southern part is Farmingdale. Farmingdale is a little more blue-collar, middle-class America. Again, as you get towards Melville, it starts stepping up. Again, you know, as you said, the Tony Scotto landscape, you got 110, then you have Bijou,
yeah.
And then you have Blackstone, and you got the Italian restaurant, I forget, across the street or whatever.
Well, across from where?
On 110, like sort of across from Blackstone with a C.
Citarella.
Yeah, yeah. And you keep going up, and then you got the Bryant.
Right.
You got the Walt Whitman Mall is pretty high scale. I mean, it's got some high-end places.
Yeah, that,
and then you continue north into Huntington. I mean, there's some parts of Huntington, and that's not so much. But I guess
if you're getting Ruth's Chris now, too. Ruth's Chris.
Yes, yes, yes.
You know, I just went to a place next door, Citrus Wine Bar. It just opened up, like, I don't know, 2 months ago, you know. Cute little place. It's like it's right next to same people own the bagel store next door, so they cut a hole in the wall, put a bar in. Here we go, you know. But you know, I met this guy Rolando, who's the owner, and nice guy. He's going to come on the show maybe next week, you know, talk about his wine bar. So he's got some interesting wines there, and I'm always skeptical when I see wine bars, because most my idea of a wine bar is kick ass. I mean, if you're going to do it, just have some great stuff there. I get the not everybody wants to pay $30 a glass. I understand that. But, you know, you can have a couple of those to satisfy the me's of the world, you know what mm-hmm. I mean? And it doesn't all have to be inexpensive. And, you know, most wine bars that I go into have what I call a salesman's list, which means the owner doesn't know a lot about wine, and they trust the salesman, and the salesman basically uses those places as a dumping ground for wines that they either have to sell or can't sell to anybody else, you know. I've been in wine bars on Long Island. I won't mention who they are, but, you know, when I have, you know, 30 wines by the glass, and I couldn't find one that I would want to drink, you know. On the other hand, there's a place called Madrian in Stony Brook, I think it is, or Setauket. And it's owned by this woman. Her name escapes me at the moment, but she's got a palate. And that is, if anybody's in that area, if you like wine at all, go to Madrian, man. She's got it going on, man. Great wines there. Cool little food selection, you know, cool place. But, you know, there's been wine bars opened up recently, and I've gone to them, and I'm like, come on, man, try a little harder, you know?
So if I were to open a wine bar, so now I'm pitching you.
Oh, listen to
maybe
this.
Maybe we can go into something.
I didn't realize you had all this money, Stu.
But, you know, I always wondered why nobody took this route. At least I haven't seen it. When I go to the Russian Tea Room, you can get a flight of vodka.
Right.
So there's like three or four different vodkas. If I go even locally here, the Dirty Taco, they do flights of tequila. And they probably have like 12 or more tequilas. You choose the four you want or whatever. Why doesn't a wine bar do something like that, which I think would be pretty cool? I mean, like, my mind goes to if I looked in the dictionary for wine bar, my mind would probably go to Salumi in Massapequa, where there's the perfect – and set myself up for disaster here. Charcuterie board.
Mm-mm. You nailed it.
There you go.
Yeah. You're getting so big.
And you know, so a nice flight of wines. And again, I don't know if it's not proper to mix whites and reds or whatever, and rosé, or you should have all the similar. But that would a nice board of meats and cheese. And in today's world, everybody, for whatever reason, is putting honey on the board.
Yeah,
or fig jam.
Yeah.
But to me, and maybe a nice baguette or a cracker, but the flight thing is what, and maybe that should be the name of my bar, Flights. but is that a practical thing or?
Yeah, no, I mean, listen, it's a wine bar staple. I mean, you know, I started seriously studying and drinking wine in the early 80s, and I switched from Amstel Light to wine for whatever reason, doesn't matter. But, you know, the bottom line was I really dove into it. And my initial experience with wine bars was the Soho Kitchen. And the Soho Kitchen was down on Green Street in Soho, back when Soho was a little bit edgy. You know, it wasn't really the, you know, shopping mecca it is now. It was, you had to pay attention when you were down there. But they had this big industrial place, and they had 120 wines by the glass. And decent food. I mean, just, you know, wine bar food, nothing crazy. But they had like one, two, three, five, I think they had six 16-bottle Cuvenets. They had stuff like, and if I'm not mistaken, David Rosengarten was the sommelier there at the time. He's sort of a semi-famous food writer. Anyway, long story short, I used to go. It was like Disneyland for me because I was like learning, right? So I get to taste all these wines. And they had first growths. They had flights of first growths, you know. You could have a vertical of Latour from, like, 76, 77, 78, 79, you know. All their champagnes, at midnight, they would pour them off at half price because they didn't want to keep the bottles overnight. It was really well done. And I haven't seen anything like it since. And probably because I know towards the end of their run there, I saw them kind of backing out some of the real big guns, you know, because I guess people weren't ordering them. It was, you know, they didn't want to lose them, whatever. But, you know, to me, I think that you can do a wine bar like that and still have even Salumi. I've talked to Josh about that, you know. He has a great selection of wines there, and a lot of them are reasonable and good value. But I always said to him, could you just get a couple, you know, just a couple, two whites and two reds. I'll buy the whole case at some point. I'll finish it, you know, and because I think you can miss on the low side just as you can be too expensive. I think you can be too inexpensive for some people, you know.
So that be said, I keep going back to my experience last night. It was an open bar, so it changes things a little bit, but waiters are walking around, can I get you a drink?
Yeah.
And somebody goes, I'll take a glass of white. That's the most ridiculous statement I ever heard in my life.
Of course, that's the people who don't drink wine.
However, as a credit to the establishment, the waiter at Blackstone said, well, what would you like?
Mm-hmm.
And again, this had nothing to do with price point or whatever.
Yeah.
But at least he did that. That's almost as annoying, and I know it's ridiculous to you also when somebody asks the wait staff, you know, what would you recommend?
Oh, God, please, yeah.
I mean, I sort of understand what the person's probably asking, you know, is there a special tonight? What's the most popular dish? So that is a little more descriptive of need to get an answer. But when you go, you know – What do you like? Now,
that's restaurant insecurity. You know what I mean? Food insecurity.
Yeah. So, yeah. But again, going back to the wine thing, you know, a glass of red, a glass of white. I know it's a Billy Joel song, but be a little more descriptive of what you want. And I was with a younger person. It was a young lady who was in late 20s, which also brought me to the thought process of how
much thoughts, dude.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Carrie, you listening?
Here you go, Tom. I always appreciate your support here.
No problem.
But, you know, how does a young person sort of develop their savvy on wine and education? And again, an event like open bar type of thing is the perfect thing because you get a taste, you don't like it, you get another glass and
sure,
try.
Yeah.
But again, I guess it's just very ridiculous when you think about it. How many varieties of wine might there be other than just four random categories, you know, sparkling, rosé, red, or white?
Yeah.
You start with four.
An orange now.
An orange. And then, obviously, there's all the different grapes and this and that. And so, I was aghast.
Yeah, no, listen. You were aghast. A thought on that. There's a lot of people that will come in and go, you know, I'll have a Pinot Grigio, which is basically a euphemism for white wine. You know what I mean? And it's the same thing. I'll have a white. They're one step up. You have levels of wine drinkers. You have the non-wine drinker. I'll have a glass of white. I'll have a glass of red. It doesn't matter to them what it is, you know. Most of those people don't really drink the wine. They just want to have something in their hand to hold, you know, and take a sip occasionally. And you have the people, I'll have a Cabernet. You know, you have a Cabernet, I'll have a Cabernet. I have a Pinot Noir, I have a Pinot Grigio. Those people kind of don't care either. And it's funny because they're supported by a lot of ignorance in the restaurant business. Like, I can't tell you how many times I'll sit at the bar. Well, can I get you something to drink? Yeah. What are you pouring by the glass? I have a Chardonnay, a Pinot Grigio, and a Sauvignon Blanc, and I have a Pinot Noir, a Cabernet, and a Malbec. All right. Well, who made them? Because it matters, you know. what year is it? It matters, you know, that kind of thing. And they look at me like I'm the idiot, you know. What the hell's the problem? I mean, what's the problem? You're the problem, you know. But it really is funny. I've had some scenes. There was a place in Naples called Zoe. It was a wine bar down in Naples, Florida.
Really?
I had a condo down there for a while, right? And I walk in there one time, and I was drinking, what the hell is it, big Shiraz from Australia. I had a glass of it. It'll come to me. Anyway, it was like $60 a glass, right? So I order a glass of this stuff, and it's gone. It's burnt. It's, you know, matterized. It's just awful. Right? And, it, you know, I'm always hesitant to send back a very expensive wine or a glass of wine. But it was, you know, it was shot, right? So I know the bartender. Bartender used to work for me up here. So I said to her, Sandy, is you have a sommelier here? And she goes, yeah. So she sends this kid over. He's like 12 years old, you know. And he comes to my, you know, my seat at the bar, and he says, what's the problem? So, you know, I said, well, here, taste this. The wine's shot. So he's giving me the side sniff, the whole, you know, kind of thing. You know, he's looking at the color, and I'm sitting there rolling my eyes, you know. So he says, you know, what's the name of the wine? Bin 707. So anyway, he goes, you know, Bin 707, it's really a reductive wine. I said, listen, spare me the speech. I'll tell you what we do. Open another bottle, and if that bottle tastes the same as this glass of wine, I'll buy both bottles. How's that? You know, and you're talking about $800 or whatever it was. You know, I'm praying it's right. You know, so anyway, he opens the second bottle, and of course, it was just, you know, different. You know, he's, oh, I'm sorry, it's okay. You know, I mean, whatever, it happens. You know, I feel bad for you. You lost half a bottle of expensive wine here. But you know, most people don't have that discerning palate, and I see a lot of wine bars. You know. They don't serve the wine at cellar temperature. If you're going to have a wine bar, you got to have the reds served at cellar temperature. You can't serve warm, you know, reds that have been sitting on the counter all day and night. Or, you know, sometimes you'll have two or three bottles backed up behind it. So, you know, they've been up there a couple of days. You know, there's nothing worse to me than room temperature red. It kind of exposes the alcohol content, you know, when it's warmer like that. All you get is this hot finish and, Anyway, I just, you know, maybe, Stu, maybe you'll get your wish. Maybe at some point I'll do a wine bar situation here in NASA, you know, if I get the moxie up to do it. But if I do it, I want to do it correctly. There was a new one opened up that I just saw. What?
Tom,
like you just had
I have the answer to your dream.
I see a light bulb just went on.
So in Farmingdale on Main Street, there was a restaurant, Grecian Delight or something.
Oh, yeah, I know, on the corner.
And it was supposed to, the family said they had enough. Somebody was supposed to come
in,
and it fell through the deal.
Yeah.
So your opportunity is awaiting you.
There's no parking there.
That is a funny statement, because I was just with my son the other day. I live in Farmingdale, and to get from one part of town to the other, there's side streets where you can go down Main Street.
Yeah.
I believe, sort of during COVID, they did some renovations on the street, and I believe they made the sidewalks wider at the expense of the roadway. So Main Street Farmingdale is a two-way street with parking on both sides,
right,
which I don't understand how everybody doesn't break their mirrors going down the street.
Yeah, 'cause it's cozy.
So. Sure. At the expense of losing parking on one side of the street, and I just came to this epiphany right now, they should have only done parking on one side of the street. They always had these huge parking areas, which they figured out how to create a stream of revenue, because now everything is meter parking. But I don't understand landscape here on Long Island. First of all, I hate driving at 5 o'clock. Because everybody turns into an animal. It's really a sad state of affairs. But I don't know what it is. On Main Street Farmingdale, people insist on going 40 miles an hour. And I guess I'm getting older. I'm going to be that guy that's driving in the left lane going 50 miles when everybody wants to go by me. But I sort of try to be careful. And nobody else is.
Yeah, no, it's driving's a completely different sport here on Long Island. Anyway, we should talk about Thanksgiving, though. We've been kind of.
I'm thankful that you remembered to talk about Thanksgiving.
Well, yeah, you know. And so for me, let's talk about this for a second, okay? You got the turkey. Everybody's going to do a turkey. Unless you're Italian, you're going to start with lasagna and meatballs.
Right, but I'm led to believe, because I read Newsday, that I have to take out a second mortgage because the turkey prices are going to be... What a world we're living in, Tom.
Yeah.
Turkey prices are going up, and there's no Christmas trees.
I know, but they keep telling me that I keep on the radio, boy, everything's rosy. You know, this whole economic thing is fabulous, and everybody's, you know... It's never been as good as it is now. I don't think anybody believes it, but anyway. So turkey prices notwithstanding, most people are going to have a turkey, even if you got to shell out a couple extra dollars, right? So leave that alone. The turkey thing, you know, you can fry it, braise it, roast it, you know, boil it, whatever you do with it, you know. It's the sides, to me, that make the dinner, right? So what are we going to do for sides? Well, we're not going to do with the melted marshmallows on the sweet potatoes. At least I'm not.
You know? My sister is cringing.
Oh, cringe all
Tom,
you want.
Tom, now you're going to – I just know what the next words that are going to cross your lips are. And if my sister's ready to jump, she will, because you're going to talk about not doing the string bean casserole.
That's the second one I wouldn't do. But anyway, that's me. So Here's my short list of cool stuff for Thanksgiving, right? I think you should make a salad because, you know, for me it's a big, you know, it's a cleansing agent, you know, and I always eat the salad after dinner rather than before. But a really cool little baby kale salad, and I would put, you know, like some chickpeas in there, some garbanzo beans if you want to be really, really ambitious. You can soak them overnight, get fresh ones.
So I have to ask.
Yeah.
First of all, the difference between lettuce and kale, I mean, because now a lot of it's a superfood, I believe, and
yeah,
everybody's using that. Yeah. I guess it's a little – kale is almost like more like a cabbage. Am I some
– Yeah, it's more like –
It's not as delicate.
No, it's a cross between spinach and chicory. You
okay.
Know?
So when I go to the supermarket these days and get prepackaged salads – a lot of times, which I know you don't like, is chopped. So when you make a kale salad, is it a full leaf? Is it a little bit broken down?
Yeah, no, you tear them just like you would a regular salad, you know. And for this, I like, you know, a little butternut squash, you know, saute it in there.
Saute. Now yeah, you're
saute
talking.
Saute it first and then, you know, cool it down, right? A little bit of sauteed red onion, pomegranate seeds, a little white balsamic vinegar. I put some tomatoes in there. But the chickpeas really give it that protein kick, you know, which is kind of cool.
So talking about tomatoes now, so what type of tomato? Would you put a sliced in there?
Cherry tomatoes, a little cherry tomato.
Okay, so here's another question. Do you cut it in half?
Yes. Yeah, it's easy to eat, you know. And you get that little blast in your mouth.
No, it's funny. I got some, like, mini plum tomatoes. I don't know what that's.
Yeah.
It's supposed to be real sweet. They were on sale. It seemed like a good deal. But they were long. Uh-huh. So, like a cherry tomato, I just slice in half.
Yeah.
These I would do in, like, in thirds.
Yeah, yeah, okay. And then the other sides that I love for Thanksgiving are turnips, because it's turnip season now.
Well, I got to put that on the list, because what is it, Modern Diner?
Modern Diner, all the turnips you want.
I got to get my order of turnips.
Yeah, it's great. You know, mashed potatoes, obviously, is and stuffing you have to do, you know. But then, for me, when it gets to green beans, you know, I like the purity of the bean. And green beans is another vegetable I don't really like to cook al dente. You know, a lot of my chef friends would argue this with me, but and it's fine. I mean, I don't mind al dente green beans, but I kind of like them a little softer than the
average. We had this conversation last week, but I got to ask you, do you trim the edges, the ends off?
Yeah, yeah, you take that stem end off anyway.
Not everybody does.
No, well, they should, you know, otherwise you're doing it all night, you know. So you have, you know, you have the green beans, and I would take a shallot and saute a shallot down because it's going to give you some extra flavor, and then saute, you know, heat the green beans. I would steam them off ahead of time.
So this is really developing into an interesting conversation, because most people would think a salad is the various cold vegetables that you pull out of the refrigerator or whatever, and you've got a whole different take on it, and it seems very exciting. So now it's very alluring, but, you know, you got the squash, you got sauteed shallot, there was something else you mentioned.
Yeah, pomegranate.
This is really turning.
The shallots and the beans aren't going in a salad. They're going to be separate. This is instead of your green bean casserole that your sister insists on making, all right, with bad onion soup mix.
And do you do any croutons in your salads? What's your thought about that?
No, I mean, you have bread on the table. You know, it's enough. But, yeah, the green beans, are to me, is a great side for Thanksgiving. Again, the turnips, and I like to mash them. I mean, you can do your baby turnips, and, you know, you can do them, saute them, and cut them in half and boil and saute them. But my grandmother used to make these turnips. They were like these yellow turnips, and she would make them like mashed potatoes, a lot of butter and a little bit of sugar. It was so good. Cream spinach is another one, I think, that's a great little side for, you know, Thanksgiving.
So let me put you on the spot. Mm-hmm. Cream spinach. Yeah. Give us a quick recipe. Walk us through preparing it.
All right. Well, you have to make a little bechamel sauce, right, which is milk, a little bit of sautéed onion, and I use a little bay leaf in there. And you're basically going to thicken that. You're going to sauté the onions, right? You're going to add a little bit of maybe a couple of whole cloves and some bay leaf in the milk. And then you're going to have to thicken it at some point. I use roux, which is a combination of flour and butter. But you can use cornstarch or whatever if it's easier at home. There's a thing called arrowroot, which is like cornstarch, but it doesn't break down when it gets heated like cornstarch does. So you thicken that, you know, and then you're just going to take some spinach and you're going to either saute it down or boil it down, however you want to handle it, and drain it out. You got to squeeze it out, and then you're going to mix that with the cream sauce. Saute, you're going to mix it with a little bit of nutmeg, salt, and pepper, and you're good to go. It's pretty easy to make. It's a little bit of a pain in the neck, but it's not hard. Carrots, to me, are a great side, and you have all kinds of carrots now. I use the tricolor ones, you know, like I did in that video. And, you know, we steam them ahead of time, and then we saute them in a little bit of butter and some sugar and salt and pepper, you know. Easy stuff. And I think that's all you need. You know, some people do the creamed onions thing. I only saw that at Thanksgiving. My grandmother used to make those. You know, whatever. You know, they take the cipollini onions. She makes some kind of cream sauce. I never thought that was a good idea. You know, there's better ways to use onions, I think, you know. But the sides are, you know, you're limited by your imagination. I mean, butternut squash puree is a fun side. You can take the whole acorn squash. You know, you just take them, cut them in half, take the seeds out. You cut them in maybe one-inch, like half moons, and bake them off. They take about 35, 40 minutes in a 350-degree oven. I season those. I put a little oil on them, season them with salt and pepper.
What about the things that people take for granted? Gravy. Is it just the au jus that's at the bottom of the pan, or do you elaborate and, I guess, put flour in and make it into a instead of an au jus, into a gravy?
Yeah, well, what happens
then
is...
Then you do giblets.
Yeah, well, giblets are, you know, what do they call them? Optional, you know. I don't think they add all that much, honestly. But, you know, yeah, if you're going to make gravy, you take the pan drippings and add a little flour to that. That's your roux. That's the flouring and fat, you know. And then you're going to add chicken broth to that, you know, chicken base. You know, some people use base, like a little cubes. I don't recommend that. I recommend, like, collagen chicken broth. It's a low-salt collagen chicken broth. It's good for that. You know, you just put in as much as you want. And I use all the vegetables, you know. When I take the turkey out, I roast it on a bunch of vegetables and herbs, right? So I'll put onions, carrots, celery, maybe some garlic, cloves, thyme, and rosemary under the bird. And I'll put some stock in there, you know, just so it doesn't dry out. And then you use that, take the bird off, you know, you scrape the pan down with some chicken stock, you know, and then you add your roux, you know, your flour, whatever. And then, you know, your chicken stock after that also. And then you just boil that whole thing, and you know, until it gets to reduced to a point where you have a lot of flavor there. And then strain it off, you know. It's a pretty easy process.
And then stuffing. There's the age-old debate about in the bird, out of the bird.
Yeah, I'm not an in-the-bird guy because what happens is you can get somebody sick doing that. You know, you got all of that raw stuff in there, and if it doesn't get through, you have to, you know, you got to cook that to about 165, 170, and what's going to happen is you're going to dry the breast out. So you're better off just doing that on the side.
Do you do it as a casserole? I mean, for some reason, when my mom does it in the bird, mm-hmm. and when it comes out, it gets into the big bowl that we press
out,
fluffy and whatever. Yeah, yeah. For some reason, my mind goes to the casserole where, you know, somebody cuts squares of stuffing and hands it out. If you do it outside the bird, how do you make it, I guess, the presentation of it coming out of the bird type of thing? Or is it like squares of stuffing?
No, I mean, I just, you know, I make it moist enough where you just scoop it out of the pan and put it in a bowl, you know. You don't want to dry it out. You cover it with aluminum
foil. That being said, I like crispy. Like, if I'm eating bread, I love, like, a baguette, you know, the Christmas. But the highlight to me of the stuffing that my mom does in the bird is the, I guess, the exterior part that's getting roasted.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the best part of the stuffing. Like, that with some gravy. Oh.
My father used to say it all the time. Crust is the best part. Then you have it. You know what I mean? Enjoy it. Go ahead. I like the middle.
Well, that's interesting you say that because I never put my mind to it. But, you know, how many kids growing up, I want peanut butter, no crust.
I know. Crust is the best part. Have at it. You know, go get them.
Okay, so we got the salad. We got a couple of side dishes.
Yeah.
We didn't get into how to prepare the turkey, but there's all sorts of ways. We talked about the stuffing. Again, we talked about the gravy. What about the wine? Do we do a red? Do we do a white? Do we do a couple of things?
I think rosé is the perfect Thanksgiving wine. I think rosé pairs with turkey is as well, if not better, than any of the others. I think a good rosé from Provence or Long Island or... You know, California, to me, not a lot of great rosés from California. You have great rosés on Long Island. You have great rosés in France and Italy, you know, to some degree. But, yeah, I would say it's a perfect time, you know, to drink the last rosé of the year is, you know, because, you know, once you get into winter, it's more red wine. And
That be said, I put a challenge out there. Stu Leonard Jr., you haven't been with us for a while. I think we need you to call in with Blake and share your thoughts on
the suggestions.
Because if I remember right, Thanksgiving for you guys is more than just turkey, and not you not being Italian, it's not lasagna on the table, but I think there's always been salmon and what goes with that. And
oh, yeah, yeah.
So, Stu, give us a call.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. A lot of people don't eat turkey. I mean, you know, I do, you know, Thanksgiving in the restaurants, and I do it in the club. And you know, you'd be surprised how many salmons I sell and how many short ribs or, you know, steaks or whatever I have on the menu. People just turkey thing. You know, to me, it's tradition. I don't love turkey, but I'll have it. You know what I mean? I'll eat it, you know, Thanksgiving just because, I don't know. I've been doing it for 70 years, you know.
So. The only problem with turkey these days in my family is there's always so much left over.
Yeah.
And it seems like there's a lot of waste because you just, I mean, in the day, my mom probably would have prepared a meal for like 20 people.
Yeah.
Now it's anywhere from 6 to 8 or whatever.
Yeah.
And I get lazy because I don't like start packing the stuff home and this and that.
Pain in the neck.
I leave my mom with like a 12, you know, she probably makes a 16-pound turkey or something. Yeah. We eat 4 ounces of it or whatever, yeah, yeah. 4 pounds of it, and she's stuck with the carcass.
15 days later, she's like, I can't tank it anymore. You know, I'm down to turkey tetrazzini.
Mom, would you want to go out for Chinese? Please.
Yeah. Those turkey daiquiris I made last night are just not doing it for me. You know? Yeah, you can have it up to here. Yeah, that's a good part about being in restaurant business. I don't have to deal with that at home. I don't eat home anyway, so it's easy for me. Well, we have to start thinking about shoving off here, Stu. We're almost out of time. Yeah, we got about 45.
Well, we got one more week to hopefully talk about Thanksgiving. If we're lucky, fingers crossed, our production team here will be able to get the show out. We've been in a process where we've usually been recording a week in advance, and here we are on Friday hoping to get the show on Sunday. I'm going to say a little prayer. Maybe assistant production genius Joe Giffray will get us the show on for this weekend.
All right. And you know what we got to do? We got to wish Bill O'Leary a belated happy birthday. Yeah,
yes,
had a birthday recently. So, hey, Bill, one of the fans of the show, good friend of the show. And
just to impress one of our other production people, Sean Lynch, a great friend of the show. He's responsible for overseeing the whole production team here at Connoisseur Media. And his parents are big, big fans of the show.
Oh, yeah.
But I want you to know that your son's a big deal, too.
Yeah, well, thank you for listening. Anyway, we're going to get out of here with Tom's 3 keys to life, as normally we do. Life is too short to drink bad wine. Treat every meal like it was your last, as I do. And keep chocolate in your life is as important as sex and pizza.
Amano Osteria and Wine Bar has been created by Adam Lovett and Tom Shawdell to bring the feel and flavors of a true Tuscan Osteria to the North Fork. Amano showcases local growers, farmers, cheese, and winemakers, marrying their ingredients with the taste traditions of the Tuscan countryside. The casual appeal, the flavors of Italy, and a moderate price structure appeal to all, ensuring year-round patronage. This North Fork eatery sends out snappy salads and seafood, pastas and antipasta, along with a respectable wine list. Amano features local vineyards and Italian varietals from the U.S. and Italian wines. The kitchen remains open until 11 and has established a later dining crowd, sparking a local nightlife dining scene. Amano is on the cutting edge of a new high-quality and affordable dining experience on the North Fork. Amano Osteria and Wine Bar, 13550 Main Road in Matatuck. Serving dinner daily, Amano is also open for lunch on Saturday and Sunday. For reservations and further information, call them at 631-298-4800 or visit them on the web at amanorestaurant.com.